X-Party to continue again, robbing the carrier blind. Start to oppose, picking up the pace. All I can see is the client's face, asking me why the judge won't let us try.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this edition of the Justice Team Podcast. We have a very, very special guest. This is an all special guest podcast. This one is called the Defense Trial Lawyer Perspective. We have very esteemed defense trial lawyers here on the podcast. I'll introduce all of them. Remember, if you have any questions, it's media@justiceteam.com. And we do have some questions for you guys later. So I'm going to start in the far corner over here, Mr. Keith Bremmer. Keith, say hello to everybody, please.
Good morning, everybody.
So Keith has, 150 lawyer firm? How many lawyers you got?
About 170, but it's a Friday.
Wow. So if you had to fire one, who would it be? No, 12. Pick 12, any 12. So Keith has Bremmer and White, very big firm. I think you have, what, 9 offices, 170 lawyers, defense all around the board. Some, you do some plaintiff stuff, too. I saw you had a $163 million QI-TAM. What is that? I don't know what that is.
QI-TAM. It's a fraud against the federal government. So you can be the whistleblower on that.
Wow. So welcome, Keith, to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Next to his left, my right, we have Mr. Bob Gonter.
Good morning.
Good morning, Bob. So Bob is at the firm of Guy Gonter.
Gates. Gonter.
Gates, Gonter.
Yeah. Proudfoot and Mitch.
Wow, I didn't know the last two. They're new?
Yeah, new.
New. Very respected defense firm. We love Bob. We've had a lot of cases, tried cases against him. He's had some success against some of our lawyers, right? So some things to know about Bob is he's done over 1,000 trials and arbitrations combined. 1,000.
A lot.
What is that? I mean, how does it make you feel? Tired?
Old?
Old.
And I saw you...
I'm getting better, though.
You had a case with a nail gun explosion?
I did.
What's that about?
A guy hooked up a nail gun to an oxygen tank, which if you ever look at a nail gun, have the chance to look at one, you'll see a warning that says, do not hook up to an oxygen tank.
I'll remember that.
At the time it exploded. But
I'm always working around nail guns, so that's super helpful.
Yeah. What's interesting about that case is I had been a lawyer for about a year and a half. Guy lost his eyes and his hearing, and Jim Crandall's picking the jury, and I'm asking Jim, you're coming back, right? And he says, yeah, I'm coming back, because he was going to go on a vacation. And I kept looking back for like the whole 2 weeks, and he never showed up again.
And that's now Judge Crandall, one of the best judges on the bench in Orange County. So before we get to Catherine, we have our drink guest here, Mr. Evan Garcia. Evan, can you tell us what we're drinking, what you served us, and why?
Yeah, it is a play on a dark and stormy. If you hold yours up, Keith, you can see that, you know, there's a dark side and a light side, kind of representative of today. I'll let you guys choose, you know, who's who. But eventually, you know, as the podcast goes on, it'll blend into one. And so I think it's kind of representative of today.
Wow. There's a little light in all of you, I think. So to my right, and we have Catherine Gayer, who I've had the pleasure of trying 2 cases against, both in Riverside, one in Marietta, one in the historic courthouse a few years ago. Very worthy adversary, and she practices mostly Riverside, San Bernardino, Orange County, you'd say?
Yes.
Catherine, say hello to everybody, please.
Good morning, everybody.
One thing I wanted to ask you is you're on the Palm Springs Youth Football Board.
I was.
What's that about?
Years ago. Well, my son is 30 now, but when he was a little guy, he played peewee football, and I was on the board.
Wow. Look at that. Yeah. Something I aspire to do. Bob Gonter knows nothing about football, so we won't ask him.
Go Hawks.
Next, we have Lisa Collinson. So, Lisa, say hello to everybody.
Good morning.
So, one quick fact about Lisa is not only does she have 3 beautiful daughters, but she wears many hats at home, and she's also, are you a Canadian?
I am no longer a Canadian citizen.
Oh,
but I was born there.
Can you say the word ABOUT for us?
A boat.
Ah, nice. We'll be picking.
I can fake it.
So, Lisa has
She has her own defense firm. She's done a lot of cases. But there's a few I've seen. Toxic Torch you've done, false imprisonment. Anyone stick out to you of just a funny fact scenario?
Oh, God. A funny fact scenario. Let's see. I would say I tried a case one time where the plaintiff was flipping up carpets. My guy was flipping up carpets and actually went like that, lost the carpet, bashed her in the face. And so she had brain damage and you name it. And so during trial, Steve Mazza hands me, while she's testifying, a note saying the demand's 150 and it's going up 50 every single day. And then I ended up getting a defense verdict. So I saved the note.
That's a frame in the office type deal. And so Lisa has maybe a little more light than everybody because you do some plaintiff stuff too, right?
Not really.
So you lied already.
Yeah. You know, I have before, but not really. Now I'm doing so much defense work that I don't have time for it. So I refer those cases to you.
Thank you. Wow. Appreciate it. And last and least, certainly not least, sorry, we have Chris well Fianza at Yoka Smith. And some stuff about Chris. You're born in Worcester.
Worcester.
Worcester, Massachusetts, but it's spelled like Worcester sauce.
It is.
Then Penn State?
Yeah, but I was the saw Joe Paterno twice. Mm. Saw the management before they were all arrested.
Wow.
Starting to serve their time. So
then Rutgers?
Rutgers, as they say back there. So
you know Tony Soprano?
He got fired already, I think. So I know Tony Soprano. I was down by where they I used to be in that diner where they would film Sopranos. So I'd see those guys all the time back there. You know, Jersey's tough, so when you go to the diner, they serve their specialty broken leg of lamb. That's how tough it is back there. So
Chris has probably tried over 75 trials with 85% defense verdicts, huh?
That's, you know, I think that's about
kind of rude.
About right. But we call some of them net defense verdicts, so which are when you plaintiff gets a low verdict, but they owe us more money at the end, so...
It's all how you write it up.
Right? Zero it out. But if they owe you money at the end of the case, I'd call it a defense verdict.
And you've had a few giant slayers, too, a few prominent trial lawyers that you've defense verdict.
I've lost to a lot of people you'd never heard of, though, so it kind of balances out.
He's lost to 12 pro pers, ladies and gentlemen.
11.
11. So I'm going to start this off, and I want to talk about the first thing, use of Sub Rosa. So one thing that we see more often than not in a lot of our cases is Sub Rosa, and for our listeners, that means whenever they're out videotaping you from a creepy van, right, with the tinted windows, when you're out playing with your kids or lifting boxes or playing with machinery. So I want to get just a couple hot takes on Sub Rosa, how you use it, if you use it, and when it's a bad time, if ever, to do it. And I'll start with Keith on this question.
Yeah, I like Sub Rosa on some of the larger catastrophic losses where I get the impression that the plaintiff is going to take the position that he or she is never going out, they're not doing anything, they're not living their life. So I've had a couple of pretty good successes with it. One of them was a trial in San Francisco on a brain injury. And basically my Sub Rosa was just Christmas Day. She was out with her three kids playing about 2 weeks before the trial date and having a great time with her kids. And in the trial itself, she said that she couldn't leave the house. She had PTSD, et cetera. So I just played that, you know, said, you are getting out. You are enjoying life to some degree. And she started crying. And then I played the Sub Rosa, and then I used it in closing. And I still lost.
Wow. Do you think it had a reverse effect at all? I mean, do you ever see that?
No, I haven't had. I mean, I'm pretty cautious in terms of when I'm going to use it, when I'm not going to use it. I had it. I don't know if it was against you guys or not. I had a Cripps case where they claimed that she couldn't go out and she couldn't hardly walk. She couldn't pivot. She couldn't lift things. And I had her loading her truck with drywall and then playing with her kids.
I think that was one of ours. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was. And
we resolved it.
And we just settled it. I mean. Yeah. So I'm not afraid to use it to share with somebody. Gary and I had a case not very long ago where his guy was claiming he needs a double fusion, blah, blah, blah. And we caught him riding a go-kart in the Glamis, and he was about 20 feet off the ground. I thought that was pretty good stuff.
So, and I'm going to ask you, Lisa, do you use Sub Rosa in your cases, videotape, that type of thing?
Yeah, I do. But I was thinking about it when you said, did it have a reverse effect? So I did have it one time where our Sub Rosa guy was following this very nice very attractive woman who claimed she had a, you know, 7-inch disc, or 7-inch, that would be huge.
Did you say disc?
Disc.
Am I drinking too much? Did she say disc?
Did she say she?
That is a good case, Lisa.
Was it a throbbing herniated disc?
Anyway, her attorney called me up and said, you know, we're going to use this against you. She's been scared. She's petrified. And, you know, we settled the case. But, you know, it had the reverse effect that time. But I've had many times where I've cut, I shouldn't say many times, but I've gotten some good stuff. People doing sit-ups and, you know, in gyms. And that stuff is golden.
So we've had a few instances where our clients have burned the investigator following them. Like, you can tell, like, they're not kind of obvious. And it has affected. They've gone to their psychologist, talked about it, and it was flipped as a sword. So I guess it. But let me ask you this, Lisa. Are there strategic points whenever you will do the videotape when you order it? Like, is there a certain part in litigation that it's gonna that's better than not?
Better after discovery closes.
Yeah. Chris, what are your thoughts on that?
I have a lot of thoughts on Sub Rosa. The first, if I assume it's the plaintiff's podcast, if you want to defeat surveillance in every single case at your deposition, when they ask you the question, what is it you can do, can't do today that you could do before, you say, I can do everything I could do before. Just, it's pain and it's more difficult. Once you say that, we'll never order Sub Rosa. There's no point, because no judge will let it in, because you already said you can do it. But you get people say, I can't lift my grandkid, and now I have a target. The best one I ever had was, it was an $8 million demand. This guy just committed a deposition that week with the portable pain pump. And at deposition, we asked him how high he could lift his hand, and we said, we don't want you to hurt yourself, and he went about 3 inches. That weekend was moving day. So he moved the washer and dryer by himself. My favorite was he had his weight set. He had two guys trying to lift it. They couldn't lift it, and they did the universal thing to make yourself stronger. You spit in your hand and then try and lift it, and they couldn't lift it, and he pushed him out of the way and lifted about 300 pounds by himself. So we actually used it in mediation. And the plaintiff lawyer, after seeing it, says, I pray that he has a twin brother. And we had a dismissal. But definitely best to do it after discovery closes, because I've heard stories where, you know, in the form rogs, it says, do you have it? And if you have it, doesn't matter how impeaching it is, if you don't identify it, you're done. So don't even think about using it, because you have to identify it. It doesn't mean you have to disclose it, but you have to identified. So to make sure we don't screw up and not disclose it, we do it, you know, within 30 days of trial.
Yeah, and that's another practice point in the discovery. If you're answering it, like 12.4 also says, do you have any photographs of the plaintiff? Not just 13.1, which is the surveillance one, but I've had a judge exclude Sub Rosa because they failed to disclose it under 12.4 for video or photograph of anybody's injuries or documentation, because that's broad enough to say, well, you probably should have disclosed any video on the plaintiff as well. So disclosure is a big thing.
I did have a blow up one time where it was perfect. You had a woman who couldn't lift anything over her head other than heavier than a PVC pipe. And I have her at her class for CrossFit lifting 100-pound over her head. And the jury said, everyone lies. So they didn't blow it up because they felt it was creepy that we were going around surveilling. They just said, well, everyone lies. So
we did have one case where they were videotaping the wrong person. It wasn't a twin brother, but it was a cousin. It was very similar. And in trial, it didn't come out till the middle of trial, and they're playing the video. And the judge looks at their client and looks at the video. And she says, wait, stop. She's like, sir, is that you? And he's like, nope, that's my cousin. So that they went all in on the Sub Rosa. It wasn't even him. So
I did face a motion recently. So we did answer the 13.1. We've got it, but we're not giving it up. And so he took me up and filed a motion, and the judge said, either give it up or just don't use it.
Yeah, because
so you kind of have the choice, so it's kind of nice.
Yeah, so you have the choice. You could either claim privilege and not use it, because you could say it's work product.
Right, right.
But you can't, really, technically, you can't do one or the other. You can't say, well, I'll claim privilege now, but maybe I'll.
No.
I'll, yeah, it's
he said, decide by May 1st what you're going to do. And
so bottom line for listeners, like, have your clients tell the truth in their deposition and wear T-shirts that say, I love my lawyer and Jesus when you walk around. So that's another pro tip for you. So I'm going to ask my next question to Catherine, and then we're going to go over to Bob. So what are the biggest mistakes that you see young lawyers make, young trial lawyers?
Yeah, the biggest mistake I see in both deposition and trial is they don't pay attention to the answer to their question. I see a lot of young lawyers bringing in computers to a deposition, and they're sitting there and their outline is on the computer and they're asking questions and they're typing. They're not looking at the person who they're asking questions of. And you can get a lot from just looking somebody in the eye when they answer your question. Same thing in trial. You see it where they're looking down at their paper, worried about the next question that they're going to ask, and they're not paying attention to the reaction that you're getting from the person in the witness stand.
So do you have any, I mean, when you have, for instance, a direct examination or even a cross-examination in trial, like, do you have an outline of how you do it, or do you just have checklists? But, like, what's your practice tip for that?
For the young lawyers?
Yeah.
I just have an outline. So, and you just prepare that the night before you're going to ask that particular witness question so that it's fresh in your mind and you didn't do it 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago. And that makes it much easier for you to remember.
Yeah. And so, Bob, what are your thoughts on that? Just mistakes you see young lawyers make, plaintiff or defense, ones you've been up against. I think it's because a lot of our listeners are plaintiff-oriented. What are some plaintiff lawyer mistakes that you see?
I totally agree with what she just said, because I see so many people come with the list, and they'll go off the list, and they're not even listening to the answer. You can get so many follow-up questions if you just listen to the answer. I think one of the other problems I have with new lawyers is that they think that they have to be tougher than you really have to be, and they try to be a little unprofessional. And my advice is just be nice. Be nice to me. Be nice to the witnesses. And it makes a big difference in how you're going to be looked at.
So what are we've had a few plaintiff or trial lawyers on here, and a lot of them have some weird, like, superstitions. Like, so I want to ask you is, you know, defense trial lawyers, I mean, are we just crazy on our side? No, or do you guys have it too?
I'm an old baseball player, so I have a lot of superstitions. I have to park when I'm in the Moss Courthouse in the same spot.
Oh, I do that too.
Yeah. In fact, the last time I got hit on a HOA case, I went there for closing argument or waiting for the verdict, and I get there and my spot's taken. And I'm going like, oh my God, what's going to happen?
So, I mean, the socks you have on, you've had them on for like 20 days, right? You're in
yeah,
the trial.
And when I'm winning, I just keep them on. Underwear, too.
Ooh, man, TMI. God.
Here's hoping for a quick Bob loss.
And Bob, thank you for coming today. I know you're in the middle of a trial and you were dark today, so I appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
We hope you lose. But on to Chris. I'm going to ask you the same question. Any superstitions for you, my friend?
I don't. Just the, you know, not superstitious, but the torture. The toughest part, people say the toughest part of being a trial lawyer is waiting for the verdict. Mm. You know, and I know that's on both sides. And people reading tea leaves and, you know, what does it mean if it's a long time? So that's the kind of the superstitious part. But I think a lot of people try one case and hang it up because they can't deal with the post, you know, once the jury gets it to deliberate. It's the toughest thing. It's the reason you have the most respect for people on all sides who do it. You know, I know most people are Bota here, but to do it every time and wait and the uncertainty and have no control, that's what I get hung up on. And you have no control, and it's, you know, the reading of the verdict is a tough thing. So,
yeah. I mean, I just leave personally. That's my thing. That's my superstition.
What I do.
It's actually a superstition. I got a big verdict one time when I wasn't there, so I justify I can't do it because it's a superstition of it. So, Lisa, how about you? Any superstitions for you in trial?
You know, I just don't shave my legs. Nice. Kidding. No, I don't have any.
God, how about you, Keith?
You know, I had a closing tie. I used to wear over and over again until I lost.
Trash that one.
And that tie doesn't see the light of day anymore. And I thought about wearing it last week for closing. I pulled it out and I said, I can't do it. So, I don't have any either.
What was the tie? It was like little ducks on it or something.
It was a bright green tie.
Dollar bills.
Yeah. So.
Whoa. Catherine, how about you?
I have the same one as Bob. I have to park in the same place when I go to Riverside, and that parking structure, it doesn't have to be the same spot, but it's the same floor in the same general location.
I'm the same way with it. It's very weird. We're weird creatures. So I want to ask you, I'll start with you, Keith. Why Why did you start with the green tie? I mean, are there any colors that you wear during trial? Do you believe in that?
Yeah, I'm kind of into dressing a certain way. I've tried cases in different areas. So I tried a case in Montana on a Ford rollover case, Great Falls, Montana, which was a really good time for 6 weeks. That's sarcasm. And I wore the same Sears suit every single day for 6 weeks. So I'm really particular on what I wear in terms of the venue and where we're at. But I do try to have some pop and a little bit of interest. And, you know, I've talked to juries afterwards, and they've always made a comment one way or the other, like, oh, we thought you dressed really great. We liked it. I had one lady thought that my sleeves were too long and they were coming out too far in my suit. So, I mean, that's how much they were paying attention. So I'm from the Valley, so I'm a little vain. So I care about that.
Well, if you need another Sears suit, you better pick it up quickly.
I know.
Did you mean Searsucker?
No, Sears Roebuck. So I went earlier, and I saw everyone was wearing kind of different clothes and doing different things and cowboy boots. So I went to Sears, and I bought just a very boring suit with some Sears shirts, and I just recycled the same three ties for 6 weeks. And it did work, by the way. And I can't say they thought I was from Montana, but it helped.
And how about you, Bob? Do you have any color patterns?
I'm pretty much the same way. I actually had a trial in West Covina years ago where a jury came up to me and said, can I ask you or can I tell you something? I said, no. And she goes, well, I just want to tell you that I like your ties. Uh-huh. Okay. So if I'm in Orange County, I'll wear the blue blazer, red, white, and blue tie, gray slacks.
There you go, the mismatch.
And if I'm in downtown LA, I'll probably wear something like this. Torrance is more conservative. It depends, he said, where you're at.
And how about you, Lisa? Do you? I think it's a little different perspective because for women, sometimes you're unfairly. We've talked to our female trial lawyers here, and they'll pay attention to what shoes you're wearing way more than what the guys are wearing, and you have this unfair bias sometimes. So, do you have to take any special precautions whenever you dress when you're in trial?
Yeah, absolutely. They're looking. I had a jury one time ask me afterwards or tell me afterwards, we couldn't wait to see what you were wearing the next day. And I was like, wow, okay. But no, absolutely. I mean, I go more on the conservative side, but kind of try and make it a hip conservative. But yeah, you got to watch it, and you got to watch your colors. And opening day, perhaps I'm in navy, and then maybe I'll wear something a little bit less traditional on some other days, you know?
Yeah,
and how depends about on you, who I'm questioning.
And how about you, Catherine?
Same, very conservative, because I do most of my cases in Riverside and San Bernardino County. And so they tend to be a more conservative group. Mm-hmm. And so nothing flashy.
I tried a case in San Bernardino last year, and one of the trial lawyers, she wore a bright red Chanel suit one day. The jurors, you could just see them staring like, what are you doing? And she's up here saying that, you know, this amount of money is just way too much money. Nobody would ever spend that much money. I just look over like, okay. Chris, how about you? What Chanel suits are you into
these days?
I know.
Yeah, just the yellow.
But what's that big H belt that you have on? I don't even know what that is.
No. So the speaking of clothing and attire, I had a closing with the plaintiff lawyer where he didn't have his collar stays in. So the judge couldn't take it anymore. So halfway through, he takes him aside and he says, you know, you got to take some paper clips. We have to put these collar stays down. He says, well, that's not too bad, Your Honor, because last case, halfway through, they had to stop me because my fly was down. So I worry more about making sure that your collar's down, your fly is up, and I think you're good to go after that shoe's polished.
And how about that, snazzy-looking watch you have on? Do you wear that during the trial, or?
It's Costco.
Yeah.
No, you know, they do watch. You know, I find that the side that they like, they find dress as well, so it's how you dress. I know Keith is a great dresser, but you know, if you're getting crushed and they hate you, they're going to say, look at the way he dresses. They'll flip it against you if they don't like you. But I've had them say, can you believe the plaintiff's ties that he wore every day? So they pay attention.
They do.
Catherine's definitely right. They, you know, they talk. And
so we're going to do it to the next topic. We're going to talk a little bit about jury selection. And I know we can, this is many podcasts. We can do this for hours and hours, but I just want to get a general sense. And I'll start with you, Bob. I just want you to talk to me a little bit about your thoughts on mini opening, and I'll ask kind of everybody the same questions. Mini opening, and then what are your goals during jury selection?
Yeah, I myself don't like mini openings, but I think the plaintiff's attorney should do one every time. The reason I don't like it is because you're going to expose a lot of the people that I want on the jury by my opening statement. So if I do give one, it's going to be very short, and obviously it has to be, but I'm not going to expose a lot of the problems that the plaintiff has with the case, because then you're going to show a lot of the people that the plaintiff's attorney is going to want to get off. My goal into picking a jury or selecting a jury, I guess, is to get the people off that you know are going to be against you. And a lot of judges, most judges, won't do for cause challenges anymore. It's really tough these days. To this Monday, we're picking a jury where the judge is going to have us ask questions of all 35 jurors, which I love, because then you know everybody who's there. You get all the questioning done, and I think that's the way it should be done every time. And I want to get people on. Jim Crandall used to tell me, don't have postal workers on there. Don't have people with beards on there because they're too liberal.
And handsome.
And good looking, yeah.
Exception to every rule.
There's always an exception.
Yeah.
But that's just kind of, and like teachers, I was just given a course at Chapman Law School this weekend about the same thing, wrought iron. I was telling that one guy was asking questions about, you're a teacher, and he kind of moved. I said, wait, you got to find out what kind of teacher they are, because kindergarten through sixth grade teachers are, they love everything. They love everybody. And
not this, that AP biology teacher with their not pocket protector tucked into their chinos.
Seventh, ninth grade teachers are the toughest people because they're dealing with young boys all the time. And then high school teachers are tough too. So there's a big difference even in teachers. But we're generally obviously looking for hardworking, conservative people.
Keith, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a couple strong opinions. So I'm big on the mini opening, and I don't think plaintiffs should do it. I think it's too risky for the plaintiff. They have to get up there and talk about the good stuff, and I get to get up there and talk about the bad stuff really fast and get it out of there. So I'm into the mini opening. So, for example, I just got out of trial last week, and it's a dastardly case. The guy fell off the roof, broke a couple legs and his foot, but there were a lot of warts behind it. So if plaintiff got up and did his 5 points for his mini opening, I was going to get up and talk about the fact that my guy had nothing to do with this fall whatsoever, and he's not going to have enough time in his opening, or she, to sell what he or she needs to and cover about the bombs I'm about to drop. So I like the mini opening. If I'm a plaintiff, I don't want to do it because I'm not going to get a chance to do my opening and then bring out my own warts in the case. For voir dire, I feel like it's sort of, I want to make a good first impression. I want to be real. I want to try to create a rapport with the jury, and I'm trying to recruit people that I think would fit in well in my fraternity that I'll relate to, that will relate to me. Of course, I have the same cues that we all have from a defense perspective. I know who the defense jurors are. We all know who the plaintiff jurors are. So I know who that they are just by having a conversation with them and having a conversation and bringing out certain things. But I'm really rushing a fraternity, and trying to get people that see things the way I do, people that are connecting with me and like me, so that I feel I have a rapport. I'm into damage control. I'd like to win every case, but I never want to take a chance that they're going to punish my client. So I think they're less inclined to really punish if they genuinely have a relationship with me to some degree. Maybe that's false expectations, but that's what I'm doing. And I love the experience. I love the voir dire, and I'm completely comfortable with it. So that's where
it goes. How about you, Catherine? Have you been using the, have you seen the mini openings a lot?
Most recently, yeah. I don't like them. I agree with Bob.
Why?
I just don't like to unfold my hand during that time period. So I'll just keep it really brief and just tell them basically why we're here, what the case is about, and I sit down.
And have you seen any mistakes that you think that plaintiff lawyers do in their mini opening?
Overselling that and not being able to support it through the evidence.
So what are some things that, can you give us an example of something that was oversold in mini opening? And just for our listeners, mini opening is you get 2 minutes prior to jury selection to tell the jury what you think the case is about or about issues before you start to question the jury or even the judge does.
Talking about limitations that the plaintiff has, and then finding out that he or she doesn't really have those type of limitations. In other words, they never lost a day from work, and then they can't do a lot of the recreational stuff that they do. I can't pick up my son or daughter, and they're not missing a day from work. So,
how about you with the mini openings? What are some things you think that the plaintiffs do well with it or poorly?
Well, first of all, the for people listening to this, you should know that the code changed 2 years ago. So the mini opening is shall. It used to be may give a mini opening. So if you have the code section, and it's good for either side, if the other side isn't prepared, they'll say, well, I don't want to do it, Your Honor. And the judge says, well, the code says shall. We're doing it. So the other person's flat-footed. The mistake I see plaintiff make is what when we do it, I'll caution the judge before the mini opening. I'll say, Your Honor, this is just a preview. It's like a movie preview. It's supposed to just get a little bit beyond what you get a statement of the case. And what is good is if you have some juicy stuff, maybe it's alcohol, maybe it's something involving sex, something like that, you inject it in so that you get more of a feedback during the voir dire process, because otherwise you say, well, you're preconditioning the jury. The mistake they make, though, universally, is you tell the judge ahead of time, Your Honor, you cannot argue in a mini opening. They get up, you know, the dastardly defendant, objection, argumentative. And then they say, and the defendant was out of control or something, objection, argumentative. The judge will say, counsel, if you can't do it without arguing, I'm going to shut you down. So they've already been reprimanded. And that's what I find is you can't argue. There's no point in arguing. The juror's mind is not thinking about who's going to win. They're thinking, am I going to be on or off the jury? Because it's so early in the process. They haven't even thought about who's who. So I like it. But I do, you know, Bob brings up a good point, is that if you do too good of a job in the opening, that one of the questions that's always asked, that I hate it, but it's if this is a race, who's ahead, who's starting behind? Somebody will say, well, the defense is ahead, or they could say the plaintiff's ahead. Why is that? Well, it's based upon the mini opening. And my point to the judge is, if he's going to use for cause challenge, say, judge, anytime you give any human being a little bit more information, they're going to process it. So to say, how do you feel, that's the disadvantage, because now it's not just vanilla. You've told them some stuff, so they start to process it. That's the one disadvantage you get, because people say, well, he did a good job, Bob did a good job, I'm kind of leaning that way, and he loses a good juror.
So, and I'll start with Lisa. Do you think there's anything that you've seen that plaintiff lawyers do well with their mini opening, that when they do it, you're like, God, that was a good move, or you know, any of that sense?
Yeah. I mean, I can't think of anything in particular, but I mean, a good plaintiff's attorney that's going to give a good opening statement usually gives a good mini opening, mm-hmm. you know, so I've been impressed.
So, I mean, my philosophy with mini opening is you lose your case in mini opening. That's my philosophy. If I'm going to give it, I'm going to give my four or five biggest warts for the defense and see how the jurors feel about it. I mean, my point is to get the jurors off that are bad for me and see how they feel. And if I'm up there pushing the good in my case or overselling, like, what are we doing here?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So that's why, like, I've heard a lot from y'all that seems like a lot of the plaintiff lawyers are making the mistake of over-pushing their agenda. I mean, is that something you've seen, Lisa?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I was agreeing with Catherine with that, for sure. They're always overselling it and yeah, make-believe crashes and things like that. I mean, I've seen some really hokey stuff, and I think the jury kind of rolls their eyes when they're seeing that before they've really heard much, you know?
Yeah. And so what are your what are you looking for, Lisa, in a typical defense juror, and say we have a an auto crash case? Like, what are you looking for?
Well, I mean, like these guys, of course I'm looking for somebody conservative. My main thing that I'm looking for is people who think $1 million is a lot of money. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't, and especially if it's a simple auto crash that really should be a soft tissue case. I'm always looking for, especially if plaintiff's counsel's overreaching, you know, I don't want to get the juror that, you know, young jurors that think, you know, millennials that think $1 million is just not that much money. So I'm usually looking for the damaged witnesses. And like these guys, I'm trying to get rid of the haters and I'm trying to keep my friends, and the ones in the middle, I think I can make friends.
So how do you feel about those young jurors, the millennial jurors?
I don't love them. Mm. You know, I feel like I said, you know, the money, they don't have the same grasp on money as an older juror has. So I think they tend to give higher numbers.
I feel the opposite about millennials myself. Really? Honestly, I feel like the younger the juror, the less they understand or value money, you know, because they haven't seen it. And that's what I mean.
Yeah. They don't value it, so they give a lot of it.
I see them, they're like, well, $10,000 sure seems like a lot of money, you know. So.
That's funny.
Yeah, I mean, that's just what my hot take is for. I mean, Keith, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I try to reserve how I'm going to feel about a millennial. I want to talk to him or her. And so, like I said, I just got off of this case, and there were three young
college graduates out there, and I was probing them. My godson graduated from Duke, and he is not money motivated at all. He's about doing good, and he's very analytical. So he's someone that I would think I would really bond with at a trial and would follow what I'm saying. So I'm not afraid if I feel in Vordire that I have a millennial that can appreciate the situation and does value a dollar or doesn't totally appreciate that a million might be a ton, does appreciate that a million's a ton of money. So I try to keep it open and see what happens.
All right. So we do a little...
And just like, real quick, on this last trial, my partner absolutely didn't want this millennial, and I kept him on there because I felt in Vordire it went great, and he did go with me. So, but it's a gamble. You never know.
So any of you, do any of you use jury consultants? Anybody here?
One time.
On the case,
One time.
And what were your thoughts, Catherine? What was your thoughts with the jury consultant?
I don't think I'll ever do it again.
Why not?
Because I know what they know. After trying so many cases, you just know who to pick and who not to pick. She wasn't telling me anything I didn't know.
So since you in Riverside and San Bernardino a lot, like what are jurors that you are not looking for?
Millennials. I agree with her that millennials are they don't know the value of $1 million. So those are the kind of people that I don't want.
And how about you, Chris?
One of the questions we use, which is always fun, is where do you get your news from? And I love the person who says, I watch MSNBC and Fox. It's like, no, you don't. No, you don't. You're trying to. But the people you're trying to watch out for are the, you know, the MSNBC, hardcore, always NPR. But you could just see that corporate hating, you know, just a, kind of a chip on their shoulder. They usually expose themselves. But, you know, we find a lot of jurors, I'm sure everyone would agree, including yourself, is that a lot of it's stealth. Jurors want to hide what they really think, and you know they want to do their civic duty and beyond, but they're not going to give you anything because they know if they say a certain thing, it'll get them kicked off. So I find they're trying to be so vanilla lately. You know, it's like you just can't get anything out of them, which makes it difficult, and they're doing that on purpose.
So we do a little Family Feud type style thing here. So I'm going to break you guys up into a couple of groups. We're going to do a top 10. So we've asked 100 plaintiff trial lawyers a question. We're going to see if you guys can nail the top 10. So Lisa, Chris, your team, you come up with the team name. Keith and Bob, your team. And then Catherine, you get the steal if they can't get the remainder of the top 10. We'll actually do the 7th because we have a limited amount of time. So this one's called the top 10 biggest mistakes that plaintiff trial lawyers make. And it's in trial, starting with trial. So, Lisa, Chris, what is your team name, first of all?
Big Bad Defendants.
Sure, we'll go with that.
Big Bad Defendants, all right. Your preconditioning, Mr. Faenza, move on. So, why don't you give us your first one, top 10 biggest mistakes plaintiff lawyers make?
Failure to prove their case.
That's not very specific.
So not hitting the elements of the case, I think, would be the number one thing that you may cover other elements, but you just don't, you forget to prove part of your case.
So, unfortunately, give him the X, Timmy, give him the X. That does not appear on the list. So you can remember, we asked plaintiff lawyers this question. They're not self-appreciative of their own mistakes. They think every case they've proved all their elements. So, sorry, you guys are already moving on to Bob and Keith.
Yeah, we're Team GB.
Team GB.
Right. Yeah, so I think the biggest mistake would be asking for too much money.
Ding, ding, ding. That appears on the list as number 2. You guys get to continue. You can confer. If in case anybody's wondering, Keith has on amazing socks. We had a discussion before we taped in the blue room. Stance, not an advertisement. I'm wearing them as well. Are right, you guys ready?
I don't know if you have this one on there. I hate to give away my secret sauce, but most of the time, the plaintiff's attorneys that I see don't ask the plaintiff to explain what their pain and suffering is. And it blows me away.
So it kind of appears on the list as number 6. It's failure to fully explain the nature and extent of their damage. Just one specific play. But that was a good one. All right, I'll give it to you. All right, you guys are still on the board before Catherine's going to come and steal your thunder.
being forthright with regard to the warts in the opening.
That appears on the list as number 4. You guys are doing good. Not pushing the landmines is how they answered it. Not finding your landmines. All right, you get to continue. We'll do one more for lack of time. If you don't get it, move to Catherine. If not, you guys can win. And we'll tell you what you win. It's a concrete bicycle. Very nice.
Not pushing the board iron enough with regard to getting rid of bad jurors for cause. So when you get that juror, you push and say, notwithstanding whatever Bob gets up here and says, you'd agree that he's not going to flip you, and you could never be fair and impartial.
The rehabilitation part.
So that appears as number 1, and it's mistakes in jury selection, inability to get jurors off for cause.
I would say that GB is on fire.
So congratulations, you two. That was very well played. So the next thing, I'm going to ask this first one to Catherine. We're going to do two more topics. First, I'm going to ask you who are the three trial lawyers that you've been up against that impress you and why. And present company excluded. You cannot talk about me. Duh.
That stinks.
So that narrows it to 50. And then the last one we're going to talk about, and if our listeners want to know, is we're going to talk a little bit about what you're doing during cross-examination of the plaintiff during trial. That'll be the last topic. So I want you guys to start thinking about that. So, Catherine, first, the three lawyers that have impressed you in trial and why. You can name two. It's cool.
If I can't name you.
Oh, see?
Actually,
our speakers are not paid to be on the podcast, by the way.
How about somebody from your firm?
Okay.
Tom Fair.
Yeah. Fairbear.
Yeah. He did an excellent opening statement in a case that we had together years ago.
Oh.
Did a really nice opening statement, and I thought, gosh, how am I going to follow that? So he did a really good job. And I just tried a case against another guy named Raul Sethi. Hmm. He does employment law. I do some employment law, too, for school districts. And he wasn't real polished, but he got out the statements that he needed to, and he hit the points that he really needed to hit, and he followed up on the evidence as well.
And why do you think that was effective? Was it, did he just hit his points, move on type deal?
He did. He knew exactly where to target on opening, and then during the evidence portion of my client's employees, he did he followed up on it and did a really good job.
And Chris, how about you?
I would limit it to one, but it kills me to say this, but Arshan Mapur, he's just good at everything that he does. But I remember we were there, and it was a death case. We had a truck driver, and he asked this following question on cross-examination to our driver: do you like French fries? Mm. And I turned to my co-counsel, Bob Morgenstern, and I said, this is not going to end well. And it's the attention to detail. So what happened was he had said the day after the accident, the question was over driving. But he said he was in Utah or even beyond that. And he'd gotten a stack of receipts as part of discovery and went through each one. And he found out he had two large fries in Barstow at the time he said he was in Utah. And the guy had no answer for it. I'm like, who would take the time to look through these tiny receipts? And it was a crushing blow. So he does that. He does the attention to detail, which I find most plaintiff lawyers don't take the time to do. And there was really nothing we could do to defend it because there was no way to anticipate it.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of people lose this. They can walk into the trial and just charm the jury and just do their thing. But it is that attention to detail. And I think Arsh is probably the best at that. I mean, he's looking at how many receipts do you guys think you produced that case?
It was hundreds because it was all his food receipts. And it was even after the accident, but that became important, and I'll never forget about that Barstow McDonald's again.
And how about you, Lisa?
I think the best voir dire I've seen was Mike Alder. Just turns on the Southern charm, and jury loves him, and that case settled.
And why? What do you think was? What do you think that he did well during the jury selection?
I just think, the way he crafts his questions. The way he responds to the jurors, he's always listening, following up. You know, something Catherine was touching on earlier. He's not that person. He's the person that's listening for the next question or listening for the answer and asking that next question. I just thought he was really talented.
All right. And how about you, Keith?
San Bernardino. Bill Shapiro. I just think he's amazing. And he did an opening statement, and I mean, I literally had a panic attack. I had to call my pharmacist and get ready for my opening after that. He's just great. I think he can get it. He could get you to tell you you're wearing a different color tie. He's really good. And it helps that the judges in San Bernardino think that they have a business relationship or partnership with him.
Oh. The sarcasm with Keith over here today. God.
Yeah, that was sarcastic. And I think Garo does a good job. I've had a couple trials with Garo, and I think he's got a good way about him. So, all
right. If you can get around the car that he brought into the middle of the courtroom.
He brought a van into, yeah, he brought a full van.
Wait, he brought a van in the courtroom?
In one trial, he brought a van, and another one, he brought the stairwell. So,
wow. Yeah. Was it the van that your clients were following his clients around in? The van without the windows?
It was the Sabrosa I didn't get away with.
And how about you, Bob? How about, I mean, you try a lot of cases, man. How many do you think you do a year?
Well, I did 7 last year, so that was a lot. And I'd have to probably say Bruce Brillet. Did a great job in voir dire, did a great job all the way around, even though I did get a defense verdict. Chris Purcell in Orange County is probably one of the better trial lawyers I've ever gone against. He actually gave me my first loss. Very astute, smart, charming guy. And then the third one would probably be Brian Breiter. Does a great job with the jury. I thought he killed me in the closing argument with his PowerPoint, but he didn't. But I thought he did a great job.
And what do you think was effective in his PowerPoint?
Well, first of all, he listed all the costs of what our experts charge. And when we were saying that you shouldn't give anything, it's hard to say that when an expert that you know, I won't mention his name, but his bill was $60,000. And he also had a picture of a cherry tree and said, Mr. Goner is just cherry picking all the things that he wants to send to his experts, and he's not sending them everything. So just little tidbits like that I liked, but apparently the jury didn't. But
sometimes it's a little too much.
It is, and I tried one with another firm recently. Gene Sullivan was involved. He didn't do it, but that firm overblew the PowerPoint. It was just too much. There was had a picture of Jesus in there that the judge didn't like. You know, the portrait where they try to show how much it's sold for, $44 million. And sometimes you can just oversell that. And my cross-examination of a plaintiff, I had a brain injury case against Mindy Bish.
That's one of Van Nuys. I remember that one.
Yeah. And I finished... I said, I have no further questions, and I'm walking back to the table, and I did that on purpose. And I had a stack of photographs from Facebook because the plaintiff said that she could no longer do things with her friends and family. And I said, oh, I do have one more question. And I put the first picture up there. I said, is this you? And she's got a picture going like this at a poker game with all of her family, and just one after another, probably 35 photographs of Facebook. And that's probably one of the biggest thing that you guys have to worry about. Mm. Is stopping that social media stuff.
Bob had just seen a Columbo marathon the day before, so sorry to bother you.
One more question.
One more question, yeah. Peter Falk. So that segue. So what? We're in the last topic. We're talking about things you're looking to do in cross examination of the plaintiff. Are there things that you think take it too far, or what do you think? There's some tips that plaintiff lawyers can do with their direct examination of their plaintiff. And I'll start with you, Bob, because you brought up the social media.
Yeah, I mean, they have to ask what the problems are. You know, you can't rely on the doctor to explain what the person's pain and suffering is. It has to come from that person. And I know you do this well, and I know a lot of lawyers do it well, but I see a lot of lawyers that don't do it at all. They just take it for granted, I think, when the person says they have neck and back complaints, but nobody ever explains it. Mm-hmm. That's the biggest mistake I see.
And for me personally, when I do a direct, I think it's the hardest thing to do, and it's the value meter on your case is how are you going to do the direct of your plaintiff. It's very hard to do because we have no control. What Chris talked about, that lack of control when you're waiting for the verdict. Same thing on cross-examination. I mean, this isn't a polished expert. This is a human being that is the first time they're ever doing it. It's scary for us on cross to see where it's going to go and how they're going to answer the question. But I like to leave them on a very emotional, sentimental note the last 3 or 4 questions before I turn it over to the defense. And it's usually just stuff like, you know, what do you miss most about being a dad? Do you think you're the best dad you can be? Why not? You know, and just start to make it real for the jurors and then turn it over and say, all right, Bob Gaunter, you go ahead and work with that one while this guy's up here crying on the stand.
Well, when the defense attorney starts crying, that means you're doing a good job.
So, Lisa, how about you? What are some things you're looking to accomplish on cross-examination, and just any tips for our listeners with handling their client?
Well, I think that it starts with, you know, one big mistake I see, and it's pretrial, is not looking at your client's medical records and your client's social media. Mm. And then when you get to trial, if you haven't done that, you're screwed. And if you have done it, then I think bringing it out with the on your direct is mm-hmm. a good idea. You know, just like what somebody was saying here today, bring out that, yeah, I can still do all of those things. Chris was saying it. And that's why my social media looks like this, you know, rather than just waiting to get killed on social media. Yeah.
So what I do is I actually take the social media that I found, or I think the defense found, and I'll take it to the expert depositions of the defense and say, is this person in chronic pain? Are they happy? Are they sad? Is social media a fair representation of how someone's feeling? And even the experts will say, no, it's not. Like, this is people in their best light. So I try to diffuse it even with the expert depositions. But I agree. I've seen that way too many times where people don't even look or they're not prepared for it. And then when you guys land haymakers on cross, our case is over. Like, we cannot ask for the money we thought we were going to ask for. Like, I will never ask for money up front in a trial, in jury selection or an opening, unless I'm very sure that my client has no bombs out there or that we know about it. Because if you're defusing a bomb on the fly, you're done. Like, you've lost all.
That's the same with the medical records. You know, your clients fill out questionnaires. And I had just a depo yesterday where he hadn't read them. And about a year after the accident, I'm pain-free. I have no pain, 000. And he had no idea about it.
Well, Catherine, isn't that? That's not my handwriting. I don't remember the record. That's not.
Those are not my brothers and sisters.
Yeah, those are my brothers and sisters. Man, one thing, whenever you're preparing your client, if I'm showing you a medical record, you remember it, that's your handwriting. The other side's showing it to you, I've never seen it before. That's not my handwriting. That's not even true. And Catherine knows that one all too well. So how about you, Chris? What are some things on cross?
I just had a trial where the whole case was blown by plaintiff's cross-examination. He killed himself. A young kid who seemed sympathetic from the beginning. He was slashed by a two-time felon who was delivering a pizza, and the defense was self-defense. So the irony is, my son, who's a first-year law student, who was in a competition for cross-examination, I said, what I'm going to do would get me an F in your class, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to let this guy just talk. And he hasn't been prepped enough, so I just let him talk and talk and talk, and I never cut him off. If I was the plaintiff attorney, and he was so into his own case and just trying to win every point. My favorite with him, though, is he says, you know, because he hurt his hand, he got slashed in his hand, he really can't golf. It's just too painful. So I said, could you turn to Exhibit 322 and page 54 in the middle there? That's your transcript from your college class year after the accident. Could you tell him what that class is there? Golf. Could you tell the jury what grade you got? I got an A. And then a redirect, they said, after a break, he says, well, I got an A because I wrote a paper for my final. And the jury didn't believe that. Mm-hmm. But the whole thing was, is he was not prepared to have his client give short answers. And the highlight of it was that he said that the reason why he attacked our delivery driver was because he was trying to defend his home, and he kept crying, saying, it's my home, it's my home. After the jury's done, we see an 82-year-old alternate, and she comes up to us and tells us what she thinks, and she does an impression of the plaintiff. It's just, it's my home, it's my home. Like, if an 82-year-old is making fun of this 20-year-old kid. But he just wouldn't stop talking, and I wasn't gonna prevent him from, and he just hung himself.
Do you think that was something that the plaintiff lawyer prepped him to say? I want, this is our theme of the case. It's my home. It's my home. And it's just overkill.
No, he was trying to convince me. In this case, it was a defense lawyer who was the plaintiff lawyer. Mm-hmm. So I think they didn't, it was all offense, no defense. I don't think they spent enough time talking about cross-examination. But I think plaintiffs don't expect you to let them just give open-ended answers. I think they think that it's going to be a yes or no thing on cross-examination. And we want people to get angry. We want them to show. So in this case, they were trying to make the felon look like a bad guy. He never got angry in trial. and the plaintiff, who we said was the aggressor, lost it, you know, was practically ready to attack me, a trial was over.
Do you think generally your case, your defense case, gets stronger or weaker after the plaintiff rests?
We spoke about that before. The defense case never gets better than when the plaintiff says, I rest. Mm-hmm. You know, so at that point, if you need an IME doctor, something you have to have to rebut, put them on. But other than that, especially now with everyone bringing so many defense witnesses in under 776, I'm sure everyone in the room has had cases where once the plaintiff rests, we rest. And if you've done a good job on cross-examination of the plaintiff, it's not going to get any better. By putting people on, like skilled people like yourself could just crush. You know, the more experts we put on, the more pitfalls we have.
All right, Keith, turning to you, what are some things you're looking to do on cross and some tips for our listeners?
Well, I guess the tips for the listeners would be to be as calculated as you can with regard to putting your witness on the stand. I mean, I definitely, for me, I think there's a beginning, a middle, and an end, and you want to end with something that debones us, and that when we get up there, we have to be cautious that it's been, you know, a sensitive moment. So I'm always prepared to get up to say, listen, this is a really hard part of my job. I don't dispute you've been seriously injured here. I represent a client that just takes a position that it wasn't his fault, and I hope you can appreciate my situation. So I'm prepared if the plaintiff lawyer has been calculated and done the right thing. So that would be my first advice, is be really prepared to, like you said, end on a really strong note with which emotionally connects with the jury, because it's going to be hard for me to get them off of that and start going my direction. The next thing for me, if I have any other advice, it's that tell the client the way you're answering your questions and being friendly and wonderful with me, do the same thing to the other side. I mean, we have a strategy and we have a theme, and you know what it is. Stick with that, but just be just as nice. Make the same eye contact. You know, don't be looking at me like, did I get that right? You're pretty happy with me, right? I'm doing good. Like, I've seen plaintiffs looking at their attorney going, I'm doing good here.
Do you call that? I do. When I see a defense witness and every witness, before they answer, they're looking at the defense lawyer, and I'll do the dramatic turn to the left, like, what are you looking at over there?
Yeah.
You know?
So I had a plaintiff expert doing that, looking at his attorney, and I said, is everything going okay? I see you keep looking at your attorney. Have you guys gone over this? I'm just asking questions here. So I have called him out. So that's my advice, is to be very calculated with regard to the beginning, middle, and an end. Definitely, you know, for me, when someone gets into pain and suffering and it's real, it's really uncomfortable for me when it's going really well for the plaintiff. And a lot of times they'll go for like a minute and then they'll stop and I'll be like, wow, this is great. Mm-hmm. I'm glad they stopped there. And they had some momentum, right? So that's that. And just to be real, be the same person that they were with you as they are when I get up there and do my questions.
Yeah, so a plaintiff that's non-confrontational, right? It should be, look, treat them, be nice, say yes, sir, yes, ma'am, and just answer the question. Right?
Just be the person you were when Bob got up there. Just be the same person. And I'll call him out. I'll say, listen, I'm just asking the same questions your attorney's asking. You seem angry with me. I just want to ask a few questions and be quick here. This is your moment with the jury.
And I do that. My last trial, I did that, like, clean cross-exam or clean direct, and then all of a sudden I ask a couple questions and they just won't answer my question. And I say, how come you answer his question so nice but you can't answer mine? Jury laughs. I'm like, all right.
We're literally. And then
and Bob, that's the sudden onset amnesia, which people do all the time on both sides, and you just can't do that. How come you can't remember anything now just because the questioner changed? It makes them look...
Yeah. I think it really affects the credibility. So there was an orthopedic surgeon on the stand, and the plaintiff was going through the fact that he wasn't recommending that the plaintiff go back to work. And then I got up there and I said, hey, I wanted to talk to you. You do agree that there is work for the plaintiff. There is work. And he said, well, what do you mean by work? Yeah. And I said, well, you're an orthopedic surgeon. You're a pretty smart guy. And you guys were just talking about work for like 20 minutes. Work, a job. Are we on the same page? And he looked at the jury. He didn't look at me. And he goes, we're on the same page. And so in closing, I went after the guy. And I just said, look, you get to measure his credibility. And I thought he was gross.
I'd like to bring a dictionary so when they do that. So you don't know the word here. Here's the Webster's.
All
you
depends on what the word is.
Do what it is. So, Captain, any last? We're going to end with you. Any last-minute tips for plaintiff lawyers that we could do better with our clients in trial? Is there anything that you could think of that's done well or... anything like that?
I think Keith hit the nail on the head. You just got to prepare them really well and make sure that they are friendly with the defense attorney, because I'm always friendly with people. There's no reason not to be, and I think that the jury would punish us for not being friendly. And I think the plaintiff has to do the same thing.
Because you can only see the words, but the demeanor, it means a lot, because the jury's
absolutely
they're looking at everything the plaintiff does. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank our guest here today. We had a very all-star defense lawyer cast. I hope to never see you in the courtroom ever again. Hopefully only socially or on the deposition, maybe. But ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for listening again. media@justiceteam.com with any questions. And I'm Robert Simon, your host for today. And remember, there's no sleep till justice. And we do have a discount with Trial Guides. We partner with Trial Guides. So if you want any of their literature, their books, there's some fantastic ones out there. Our listeners get 15% off. You just enter JusticeTeam19 at checkout. You get 15% off all their stuff. So thanks for listening, everybody. Until next time, no sleep till justice. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
It's late at night. Notice comes to me. Defense is going in. Ex parte to continue again. Robbing the carrier blind. Start to oppose, picking up the pace. All I can see is the client's face, asking me why the judge won't let us try. Judge's eyes and can see her face looks pain. She's turned her gaze up to the skies, far away on a plane. Defense whines and they start to lie about how they need more time. They pray for relief and I cry. This was filed in 2005. Oh.